Coming up on the show today, President Biden builds a wall.
Wall construction is raising questions because the president condemned wall spending while campaigning.
Plus, an update from the Pentagon on funding for Ukraine.
There's $1.6 billion left to replenish the Pentagon's weapons stockpiles and no money left to provide Ukraine with long-term security needs.
And later, more than 100,000 Russians, mostly young people, have fled to Armenia to avoid military service in Ukraine and President Vladimir Putin's repressive policies. VOA is there. Today is Friday, October 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA's headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. A conversation with our immigration reporter coming up in a few minutes, but first, President Joe Biden is defending his administration's move to use Trump-era funds to build roughly 20 more miles of a wall along the southern border. This after he promised he wouldn't add to the wall during the campaign. Sagar Meghani reports.
The Biden administration waived 26 federal laws in South Texas to allow the construction with funds approved in 2019, before he became president.
They have to use the money for what it was appropriate. I can't stop that.
The president says he asked Congress to redirect the money.
They didn't. They wouldn't.
Asked if he thinks walls work.
No.
Still, waiving federal laws for wall construction is raising questions because the president condemned wall spending while campaigning. Mexico's president calls the Biden move to allow wall construction a setback. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
And helping us make sense of the immigration issue is VOA's immigration reporter, Alini Barros. The federal government is under a lot of pressure. Republicans in the House want to spend money securing the border and not helping Ukraine. Two Democrats, the mayor of New York City and the governor of Illinois, are really fighting the Biden administration hard. So is there a problem? If there is, what is it? And are we really seeing higher than normal levels of people trying to cross the border? Or are these just political talking points?
I wouldn't say that we're seeing higher than normal levels. I will say that we're still dealing with pandemic consequences, and we're dealing with the biggest migration exodus that we've ever seen in the Western Hemisphere with Venezuela. And we have more than 7 million people that have left Venezuela. But I will say that the administration has tried to put in place guidelines to make sure people do not come to the border. The problem is that it becomes bureaucratic, right? People want faster and they want quick results because they're trying to leave their country. They are trying to get a job and they are trying to move on. And sometimes, especially with immigration, when you're getting through documentation and vetting, it's not as fast as people wish.
Now, the big news on Thursday is President Biden's reversing course and is using executive action to finish building or continue building the border wall that his predecessor, Donald Trump, set into motion and that Biden was firmly against during the campaign. So can you tell us what's happening there? Why his complete 180?
So what the DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, what he said today was that this is not a new administration, new policy in the administration. This is funds. We have funds from fiscal year 2019 that had been already appropriated and they couldn't do anything about it. It was not rescinded. So they had to use the money, the funds that were appropriated for this construction. Now, there has been lots of criticism from especially immigrant rights groups saying that this is not something that was, you know, promised. This is a broken promise. So I'm wondering what else the government, the administration is going to do in the next day, because people are really talking about that, saying, calling the Biden administration, calling President Biden, calling him out and saying that he just broke his promise, even though he said that he does not believe the border wall works. That he told reporters today that no, that border walls, they do not work. So we'll see what else is going to happen.
And it seems like one of the other people criticizing Biden for this decision is the president of Mexico, Obrador. He said this is a step backwards.
No, he said this is a step backwards. But he also said something that he understands the pressure, which I thought it was interesting. He's criticizing and at the same time he's saying, I understand that these are strong pressures.
There is a delegation of Biden cabinet officials in Mexico now. I would presume this is what they're talking about.
They could be talking about that. They can also be talking about what other guidelines they can do to slow down migration, what else Mexico can do. And there's another thing happening in Mexico. The Mexican Supreme Court is actually, there's a case that is talking about dealing with the Remain in Mexico policy that was under the Trump administration. We don't know what's going to happen with that case. But if the judges in the Mexican Supreme Court say that the Mexican government cannot accept other foreigners, or other citizens who are not Mexicans, I'm wondering what's going to happen, because people will not be able to just stay in Mexico, right, and wait there. They have to be sent to their country. So again, there's a lot of uncertainties in immigration, because you're dealing with the United States of America and Mexico, and then other countries and then other people coming to Mexico. So there's a lot of moving parts, and the way officials respond, it depends on what's happening at the border at that week, at that month, at that day.
Well, it's no doubt a complicated and evolving situation. Alenia, look forward to talking to you in the future as the situation changes. Alenia Barros covers immigration for The Voice of America. Alenia, thanks for your reporting on this. Thanks for your analysis tonight.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. On Thursday, a Russian attack on a village in northeastern Ukraine killed at least 51 people and injured another six. The attack occurred as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was in Spain lobbying Western allies for more military assistance, including air defense. In a strongly worded report submitted to the United Nations Human Rights Council on Thursday, UN human rights experts have called for urgent reform of the U.S. criminal justice system to combat what they say is systemic racism and racial discrimination against people of African descent. At least 60 Syrians were killed and over 100 wounded on Thursday when drone attacks struck a graduation ceremony for army officers in the city of Homs. After the attack, the government bombed towns in the rebel-held province of Idlib. The number of casualties there is not known. And not far away, U.S. F-16 fighter jets shot an armed Turkish drone out of the skies on Thursday over northeastern Syria. This after the drone flew too close to U.S. troops on the ground. Future U.S. funding for Ukraine was up in the air on Thursday as the Biden administration discussed how best to support Kyiv in its war against Russian invaders without a House speaker to bring Ukraine aid packages to a vote. VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carlo Babb has more.
President Joe Biden meeting with his national security team to discuss the military aid situation for Ukraine. With the U.S. largely divided over funding to the war-torn Eastern European country, Biden plans to speak directly to the American people in a speech emphasizing that supporting Ukraine is the right thing to do and the best strategy for U.S. interest. It is the right thing to do, analysts say, because Russia violated Ukraine's sovereignty as guaranteed under international law. And because Russia broke its own agreement with Ukraine made in the 1990s, when Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons in return for assurances that Russia would respect its independence and protect it from nuclear attacks. Colin Cleary is an adjunct professor of political science at George Washington University.
So they're violating the essence of agreements that they've made, and that's very dangerous. That means, what is the nature of international relations? Agreements are not valid. Principles of the UN Charter are not valid. We're left with sort of the law of the jungle.
And it's in U.S. interest, officials say, because an expansion beyond Ukraine into Poland would obligate U.S. forces to defend Warsaw and spark a third world war. Officials say they are preventing that scenario with U.S. military aid, a whopping $48 billion so far, a sticker shock number to the average American, but less than 5% of the U.S. military's budget. Instead of fighting over aid amounts in the short term, former officials say the U.S. needs to think long term. Retired General Frank McKenzie is the former commander of U.S. Central Command.
This is going to be a long war. We should maybe prepare now for another year of this fighting. And we should do the things that we can do to ensure that the next time the Ukrainians launch an offensive, they're going to be even better prepared than they were now.
The Pentagon can provide Ukraine up to $5.4 billion more in military aid under the Presidential Drawdown Authority, which allows the Pentagon to take from its own stockpiles. There's $1.6 billion left to replenish the Pentagon's weapons stockpiles, and no money left to provide Ukraine with long-term security needs under the Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative.
We have enough funding to last for a bit longer, from a Department of Defense standpoint. And you'll see this next week at the UDCG. Secretary Austin remains singularly focused on making sure that we're working with Ukraine and our allies and partners to get what they need to be successful on the battlefield.
Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin will host another Ukraine Defense Contact Group for Ukraine's allies in Brussels next Wednesday. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
From Washington, it's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. More than 100,000 Russian citizens, many of them young people, have gone to Armenia to flee President Putin's repression or to avoid being sent to fight in Ukraine. It's an exile that many of them believed was temporary, but is starting to look permanent. Ricardo Marquina filed this report from the Armenian capital, Yerevan. It's narrated for us by Elizabeth Chernoff.
These Russian men and women meet in a cultural center in the Armenian capital to do something that in Russia would land them in jail. Openly discuss the political model they want for a future Russia. Starting last year, thousands of Russian political refugees arrived in Yerevan to escape Russia's repressive climate. Integration in Armenia is relatively easy since many Armenians speak Russian. The first arrivals were largely young people with information technology professions that allowed them to work remotely. The profile of those coming changed when it became clear that Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine would be prolonged and military conscription widened. Darina Maitskaya coordinates a discussion group in the association supporting exiled Russians known as the ARC.
When the mobilization began, many men arrived of many ages, from 18 to 60 years old, since in Russia they can take you to war no matter how old you are, and the vast majority of them were people who did not have an IT profession.
One of the thousands of men who received a conscription order was Arsen Omarov, a telecommunications technician who was fired from Russian public television after leaking documents in which he appeared to be affiliated with the opposition leader Alexei Navalny. After getting the conscription notice, he got his motorcycle ready for the 2,200-kilometer ride from Moscow to Yerevan.
My motorcycle had broken down. The engine was at home, the chassis and wheels in the garden. When I returned home from work, I repaired it, put the engine in. At nightfall, I shined some lights on it so I could work on it. And at dawn, I left.
For those who fled Russia and left their jobs behind, the fight is on for economic survival. But necessity breeds creativity. And this group of theater artists worked to put together the premiere of a play that satirizes the Russian political structure. As a result of their work, they can raise their families in a new country. Working in Russia during a time of war, censorship, and propaganda would not have been compatible with their moral positions. Sergei Selikov is a Moscow theater producer who fled to Armenia at the beginning of the war.
I believe that in the context of the war, there would be no space for cinema or theater in Russia. But the state is spending a lot of money on it, and many people who did not work before now have jobs. However, I cannot work on these projects, which are almost all propaganda.
For many Russians who have fled, the question is always the same: to return or not to return. Arsen Omarov believes he will never go back.
Of course, not while there is a war or while the same people remain in power. Returning is not an option.
The war has pushed out many young Russians who oppose Putin's policies, casting them across the Eurasia region, an entire generation forced to choose between what they see as an unjust war and exile. For Ricardo Marquina in Yerevan, Armenia, Elizabeth Chernev, VOA News.
Uganda's main opposition party has released video of its leader, Bobi Wine, being led away by security agents who took him to his home after Wine arrived back in the country on Thursday. Reuters' David Doyle has more.
Ugandan opposition leader Bobi Wine was forced into a car by security agents and driven home on Thursday as he returned from a trip abroad, his party has said. Video published on social media by the National Unity Party showed Wine being led away after disembarking from a plane in Entebbe.
Where are you taking him?
The action appeared intended to avoid a public spectacle. Police had said on Wednesday that anyone on the streets to welcome Wine would be arrested. That followed calls from his party for a million-strong march. Wine, a pop star whose legal name is Robert Kyagulanyi, is Uganda's strongest political challenger to President Yoweri Museveni, who has been in power since 1986.
People power!
Wine was runner-up in a 2021 election that he said was marred by fraud.
As we speak right now, I'm officially not in Uganda because I did not go through migrations. They picked me illegally, like you saw. And as we speak right now, I'm under house arrest because my house is surrounded. Soldiers and police are all over.
Police spokesperson Patrick Onyango said security agencies had accompanied Wine to his home, but denied that he was under house arrest. He said the heavy security deployment there was for general security. Wine has been detained multiple times in the past while leading protests that have been dispersed with tear gas, rubber bullets, and beatings. At least 54 people died in protests that erupted in November 2020, ahead of the last presidential election.
David Doyle of Reuters reporting. And finally today, the old saying is that diamonds are a girl's best friend. However, following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, there's an effort to prevent diamonds from becoming Russian leader Vladimir Putin's best friend. Russia is the world's biggest producer of diamonds, and the G7 group of nations is pushing for a ban on diamonds mined in Russia. But as Henry Ridgewell reports, it's going to be difficult to stop them from entering the global market, which is worth $87 billion per year.
About a third of the world's diamonds are mined in Russia by the state-owned company Alrosa, profiting the Kremlin by more than $1 billion annually. At the May G7 summit, members discussed imposing a ban on Russian diamonds. Enforcing it won't be easy, though. Almost all of the world's diamonds are cut and polished in the city of Surat in India. Edan Golan is a diamond industry analyst.
In the case of Russian rough diamonds, if they're polished in India, from the standpoint of American regulations, those are Indian diamonds. And because of that, they're no longer Russian.
The Kimberley process, enacted in 2000, introduced traceability for uncut diamonds to prevent the profits from fueling conflict. But it doesn't apply to polished diamonds, and the system is flawed, says Golan.
The question was, how does the Kimberley process address a parcel that will have rough diamonds from multiple origins? And the solution was, let's just put down mixed. So now if you have a parcel that is entirely Russian diamonds, but one diamond in it comes from another country, now it's a mixed parcel.
Not everyone supports the proposed ban. A G7 delegation traveled to India last week to seek its cooperation. But New Delhi is skeptical, says Golan.
First of all, without Alrosa's production, they're going to be losing a third of the global production coming in. Secondly, they don't want to join India in general. Does not want to join sanctions on Russia because they're global politics are different than those of the United States and Europe.
The European Union in May outlined plans for a global tracing and enforcement system to cut Russia out of the market from 2024. Charles Michel, president of the European Council, spoke at a press conference following the G7 summit.
Russian diamonds are not forever.
Under the EU's plans, diamonds would be issued with a blockchain-protected certificate of origin that could be inspected at trading hubs like Antwerp in Belgium. However, some fear the system could backfire. Professor Cohen van den Bempt is an economist at the University of Antwerp.
Probably they will not pass through Antwerp anymore. This large trade will just move to Dubai and from Dubai to India or directly to India. Typically countries, yes, that will not and probably never impose sanctions on Russia.
Other industry players are pushing for a less technological, trust-based certification system, which would make compliance easier for smaller diamond mines in places like the Democratic Republic of Congo. Details of the G7 proposals are expected to be outlined in the coming weeks. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Over 2.5 years ago, the military seized power in Burma in a bloody coup. The regime has left Burma in ruins, with 4 out of 5 townships affected by armed clashes between the military and those that oppose its rule. The results have been devastating, said USAID Deputy Administrator Michael Schiffer in recent congressional testimony.
Today, due to the military's brutality, there are over 1.9 million people displaced in Burma and nearly 1 million refugees in Bangladesh and Thailand. The internally displaced communities are facing increased threats of violence from the military and facing ongoing trauma due to a conflict, a bungled COVID response, epic mismanagement of the economy, high food prices, and frequent displacement that has severely impacted the coping mechanisms of the internally displaced communities.
Through USAID, the United States has led the international community's humanitarian response to Burma and the Rohingya refugee crisis in Bangladesh by providing nearly $2.1 billion since 2017, said Deputy Administrator Schiffer.
We deliver humanitarian assistance to the displaced, conflict-afflicted, and other vulnerable groups by leveraging our partnerships with humanitarian organizations that deliver assistance to beneficiaries based on verifiable need.
And although at times this work has required engagement with governing authorities in Burma, said Deputy Administrator Schiffer, we do so with humanitarian principles first and foremost in mind. In Bangladesh, USAID supports emergency preparedness and response capacity of host communities in Cox's Bazar district, including funding for humanitarian coordination, nutrition, protection, and risk management. USAID also provides emergency support to pro-democracy activists and ethnic support organizations, civil society leaders, journalists, and human rights defenders, explained Deputy Administrator Schiffer. This ongoing assistance provides a critical safety net and includes temporary safe houses, subsistence living expenses, emergency medical needs, digital and physical security, legal aid, and psychosocial support, enabling individuals and entities to continue their work for a democratic future for Burma. The road ahead in Burma remains challenging, warned Deputy Administrator Schiffer. Nevertheless, USAID remains committed to provide the people of Burma with the support they need during this crisis, prioritizing humanitarian assistance, civilian protection, including early warning and early response, and support for the development and growth of governance institutions to advance U.S. policy objectives of a just, peaceful, inclusive, federal, and democratic Burma.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.